I'm Jonathan Aberman. Coming up on today's show,
I do think there's still loads of money to be made in satellites and, you know, stuff in low Earth orbit. There is some interest in getting more tourists up there into low Earth orbit.
Welcome to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.
I very much grew up convinced that one day I was going to live on the moon. But it's true, I'm of that generation. Space race was very much a part of my childhood. Well, now we're in the middle of a new space race, perhaps. Are we really now reaching for the planets? Are we heading towards Mars, as some of our leading entrepreneurs say? Well, these are interesting questions, and I'll tell you, recently with those in mind, I read a book that got my attention entitled A City on Mars, written by Kelly Wienerschmidt and her husband, Zach. I reached out to them and asked them to join us in the show because they have some very interesting things to say about how easy is it going to be for us to actually take Mars and make it our own. So here's our conversation.
Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I must say that I'm a space geek. I grew up, I majored myself here. I grew up on Gemini, Apollo. I remember when men landed on the moon. And I'm looking at what's going on in space right now and all the activity and excitement around it. This is the most exciting time to think about space, probably in the last 50 years. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The very quickly declining cost of sending mass to space, and the fact that tourists can go up there, and you know the cost of tourism is going down. I do think it's a very exciting time.
It's really interesting to me because so I'm a venture capitalist. That's my day job. And a number of years ago, it was probably 7, 8, 9 years ago, I was teaching entrepreneurship at a local business school, and the student says, well, what are the next big industries going to be? And I said, space. And they looked at me like I was crazy, but it is. So it's happening. You're seeing it. I'm seeing it. And then you and Zach decided to actually take a critical eye and look at whether or not we are actually at the cusp of, you know, Asimov's foundation, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I got to admit, I started that book and wasn't able to finish Foundations. It just didn't work for me. But
it's a good sleep aid, actually. Very good sleep aid.
Yeah, a fantastic soporific. And so, right. You know, there's tons of money going into, for example, satellites in low Earth orbit. I'm coming to you from a Starlink satellite connection right now. And so there's a lot of money going into it. But what we were interested in is, are we getting to the point where now we can start settlements? And so we think of settlements as places where you have children, you stay for generations. And we were sort of under the impression from, like, you know, things you might hear from Elon Musk, for example, that all that we need for settlements is to be able to move enough mass to space to keep humans alive. And it seemed to us that if the costs were going down, that should be happening pretty soon. So we thought, it's time to write this book.
Now, so not everybody is going to be as geeked out of space as you and I are. So let's bring our audience in. When you talk about mass, when a space person talks about mass, what are we getting at?
You know, we're just getting at, like, so to live in space, you would need a habitat that was, like, pressurized. So, like, maybe a big metal cylinder to protect you from the outside. It would need to be pretty thick to protect you from radiation, although you could also pile some dirt on top of it to protect you from radiation, too. But when we talk about sending mass to space, we just sort of mean all of the stuff, the technology, the metal that you would need to move to space, and in particular, for my interests, to keep humans alive. And it's going to be, you know, many, many tons.
So it's very interesting. So the issue with space and is fundamentally that we're here. There's something called gravity, which mm-hmm. at least to this point, everybody seems to agree is a thing, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Gravity, you believe in gravity. It's hard to ignore. So gravity, the gravity well keeps us here. And in order to get things out of the gravity well, all the things we need to live, literally everything we would need to live in space, we have to get out of the gravity well. And that takes mm-hmm. energy, it takes propellant. So for years, we didn't have the capability to do that. So now we do with SpaceX and cheap rocketry. So the argument is, well, now we can get mass into space. So you and Zach look at it and say, oh, okay, we're futurists. Okay, I get it. But let's actually think about whether or not if we get the mass into space, whether or not we can actually be a spacefaring race. or humans can be spacefaring. And well, I don't think that you concluded that we can. And I'm so let's, I mean, but it wasn't a, it's a, why did you, why, where did you end up on this? And give me some examples.
Well, so, you know, Elon Musk says that we're going to have boots on Mars in the next, you know, like 4 years or something. And 2 decades after that, we will have 1 million people on Mars. So to us, it sounded like, okay, if that's the plan, then we must know how human bodies respond to space. We must know what the, you know, what the laws are regarding starting settlements in space. Like everything else must be figured out, and it must just be a matter of getting Starship off the ground and to Mars. Mm-hmm. But actually, when we dug into it, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. So, you know, we've learned a lot on the International Space Station about, you know, how the human body responds to essentially zero gravity. So the International Space Station is constantly in free fall around the Earth, moving very quickly. And when you don't have any pressure on your bones or your muscles, they, you know, start falling apart pretty quickly. So, for example, astronauts lose about 1% of the density of the bone in their hip every month. That's a lot, and that's pretty quick. Mars, for example, has 40% of Earth's gravity. And we don't know if that's enough to drop that bone loss to nothing, or if it drops it to 0.1%. But, you know, if that adds up over a lifetime, as opposed to just like 1 year, which is a long trip for an astronaut, that could be a problem. We also don't understand space radiation well. The legal status of settlements in space is a little bit unclear. We don't know if you can sell space resources. The U.S. has an opinion on that. But like every level you dig into when it has to do with biology or law or geopolitics, it's complicated. There's a lot of things we still need to figure out, and it's more than just sending mass to space.
Were you somewhat disappointed to actually learn that people really haven't thought these things through yet? Because that seems to be my impression.
I was heartbroken. And partly I was heartbroken because, you know, I think settlements would be cool, but also I had become friends with a bunch of the people working on this. And now I'm like, you know, not invited to the space parties anymore because I'm like kind of a downer. But, you know, there are people working on like these different problems, but they're sort of siloed and it's hard to get an overview of all of the problems. And so this book tried to like jump into a bunch of different topics. And sort of the picture that adds up is that there's just a lot of stuff that we still have to figure out before we go up there.
So let's start with physiology. I, as you and Zach pointed out in your book, you know, we don't have more. I mean, the most data we have is I don't think anybody's been in the stations, in a space station for a year at most. Right. And so we don't know what space does if somebody is outside of Earth's gravity for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. We just don't know. We don't have the data.
That's right. Yeah. The longest day has been 437 days. And I think right. That was on the Soviet in a Soviet program.
Mm-hmm. And then they had to go back to Russia. So we should feel very bad for them.
Very bad for them. Yeah.
So what does the data so far show that leads you to be concerned that we're not necessarily currently configured to be spacefaring?
Well, so for starters, it's important to note that the International Space Station was not sent up as a way to collect data for preparing humans to settle space. It was sent up, you know, for other reasons, geopolitical. We wanted to know about how human bodies respond to no gravity, essentially being in free fall. But, you know, there haven't been a lot of experiments looking at how partial gravity impacts bones, which we've mentioned. But additionally, radiation in space is different than the kind of radiation that we encounter here on Earth. But the International Space Station and all the stations that have come before are orbiting underneath the magnetosphere, which captures the space radiation. And so it's not getting to the astronauts. So we don't even have good data on how space radiation impacts human bodies for, you know, 6 months or a year at a time, you know, however long the astronauts have been up there. The 24 guys who went to the moon and back, they provide all the data that we have for knowing how human bodies respond to space radiation. And their trips were only 2 to 3 weeks long. That didn't seem to be immediate death. So that's a good sign. But when you know, throw together the impacts of partial gravity, the impacts of space radiation, there's also some signs that like that vision degrades, you become more nearsighted over time. And that could be because of fluid shifts sort of pressing on your eyes. And there's just a lot of problems that maybe we could solve. And maybe they won't be problems at all. You know, for example, when we were you know, preparing for the Gemini and Apollo programs, we were a little worried that maybe astronauts in space wouldn't even be able to swallow and eat food because, you know, what's going to happen when you're not feeling Earth's gravity? And that was fine. So maybe we'll laugh that we were ever worried about partial gravity, but we just really don't have the answers yet. And that might not be a problem for a trip to Mars and back. But if you're thinking about having babies in that environment, it seems to me that we need a lot more data before we do that.
Well, that was another thing that I thought you highlight in the book, you know, very well, which, you know, the process of getting pregnant, the process of giving birth, are both processes that require, that actually rely pretty heavily on gravity.
As far as we know, yeah, they do. They seem to rely on gravity. And again, you know, on Mars, you've got partial gravity. You might have to worry. So it takes about 6 months to get to Mars. And during that time, unless your facility is rotating, you'd be exposed to zero gravity. Maybe that would make it hard to conceive, or maybe that would impact the development of the fetus negatively. But there's a lot we don't know. There have been some like rodent studies on the ISS, but they've been sort of not very systematic.
The idea of an unsystematic rodent survey in zero gravity, I must admit, it's appealing to the weird sense of humor that I have. So thank you for sharing that image with me. And then I think you also pointed out that, you know, Mars actually is full of really toxic stuff that nobody's actually thought through, that Mars dust is actually really bad for human beings.
And it's bad in multiple ways. So one of the ways that it's bad is that, you know, unlike the sand on Earth, the regolith that you would find on Mars, and so that's what they call the like blanket of sand on top of Mars, it's much more jagged. So you're going to have to worry a lot more about breathing it in because it might scar your lungs. So you're going to have to be very careful to keep it out of your habitat. Additionally, it's got perchlorates in it. So this is an endocrine disrupting hormone. Essentially what it does is it binds to your thyroid. It messes with things like blood pressure and heart rate. And this is in the soil. So you're going, or in the dirt, you're going to want to be very careful if you are planting plants in it, because it gets picked up by plants. And that's, you know, something else you're going to want to make sure your kids are not exposed to in their food or water.
It's good advice. And I plan on following it. So we're here with Kelly Wintersmith, the author, with her husband, Zach, of A City on Mars. When we come back, Kelly, now we've sort of talked about, hey, we need to think about these things. Let's have a conversation about what we should be thinking about, and how do we actually make sure that the science fiction fantasy many of us share actually comes to fruition. So we'll be right back. Working in Washington? That's a question we often hear. The reality is, Washington works every day at looking at the issues that have to be addressed, solving problems when we can, but more than anything, the crossroads for where change will occur and needs to occur. This show, What's Working in Washington, brings voices into the studio so you can hear from them what they want to do and how they want to contribute. We love hearing from our listeners. You put us in touch with some of the best voices in the Washington, D.C. region. We've been hearing from you and speaking to the people you want to hear from. That's what What's Working in Washington is about. We talk to the power players about innovation in the federal government and how business in the region is keeping us competitive. But more and more, we talk about the hard questions and look for the real answers that will drive the region and our nation forward. If you know someone we should be talking to on our show, do let us know. We look to shine a spotlight on people who are really getting things done in the region. So please keep those ideas coming. And thanks to all of you who stay in touch with us. And we're back. We're here with Kelly Wintersmith, who co-authored with her husband, Zach, A City on Mars. We sort of, you know, between you and me, we did a great job of fire hosing the idea that we're ever going to get to space, right? But that wasn't the point of your book. The point of your book was not to say we can't go. So let's talk about what you're advocating for.
Well, so I would love to see space settlements happen. I've sort of lost hope that they'll happen safely in my lifetime. But, you know, for some of those biology program or problems that we talked about, if you had a research station on the moon, you could do things like, you know, have rodents live through multiple generations and make sure nothing seems to go wrong with radiation. Then you could, you know, the scientists could bring their dogs along. We could see how that goes. There's a lot that we could learn about space radiation and partial gravity. And at the same time, when we're out there, we could be doing things like testing our power sources in space. For example, we might want to have nuclear reactors. Mars has planet-wide dust storms that block out the sun sometimes for weeks at a time. You might not want to have to rely on solar panels in that situation. So we could test out our nuclear reactors and we could, you know, figure out the right kind of habitats to keep space radiation out. There's a lot of testing we could do on the moon. So most space settlement advocates are not excited about the moon as a place to live permanently because it just lacks so much of the stuff humans need. But it's a good place to go to learn how to settle space before we go to somewhere better, in my mind, like Mars.
So we're talked so far, I'm really focused on human exploration. But we haven't talked about a lot of energy that's being put into the idea of mining, asteroid mm-hmm. mining, right? What's your thinking about that as an alternative source for rare earth minerals, which I guess wouldn't be rare earth if they came from an asteroid that we found in Nepper Belt. But what's your thinking about that?
So most of the folks that I spoke to who advocate for things like going to the asteroids to get resources, they're no longer particularly excited about bringing those resources back to Earth because, you know, going out to mine them and then sending them back to Earth, one, that's going to be incredibly expensive. And if you do, for example, get, you know, tons of platinum, bring it back to Earth and sell it there, you might crash the market and then you're not going to get the profit that you wanted. But in the near term, it seems like the thing that is holding those kinds of companies back is that there's a lot of legal uncertainty about what you're allowed to do. So the 1967 Outer Space Treaty through the United Nations governs most activities in space, but it's a little bit vague. So it says you're not allowed to claim sovereignty, but it doesn't say what you're allowed to do with resources. So the United States' interpretation is that you can extract resources and sell them and that that's a thing that's different than sovereignty. And a lot of countries have signed on to our interpretation. But talking to some people who were in the asteroid mining community, it sounds like there's still not quite enough certainty to get the venture capital that you needed because maybe you're going to invest, you know, I don't know, millions, billions of dollars in this technology. And then the international community might be very mad at you for extracting and selling resources that they think of as belonging to everyone. And you might not get the profit that you expected. So clearing up that uncertainty might help that business. But at the moment, we don't have perfect clarity there.
So you mentioned policy. Does this mean that ultimately figuring out how to commercialize space or take advantage of it is ultimately going to be an area where really DC is going to have or should have a leading role as a business and tech community?
So they have been an important part in the U.S. of trying to clarify what these laws mean. So there was Obama in, I think, 2016 signed the Space Competitiveness Act, saying that our interpretation of the Outer Space Treaty is that you can go out and extract and sell resources. We encourage our citizens to do that. Trump had an executive order, I think, in 2020 that said the same thing. So maybe this is like the only thing our political parties agree on, that our people can go extract and sell resources. And then NASA came up with the Artemis Accords, and over 20 countries have signed on to that. And so it does seem like the U.S. is leading the way and trying to clarify things. But, you know, countries like China and Russia haven't signed on yet. And those are the other countries that would probably be the most likely to be able to go out there and mine as well, although maybe not Russia anymore.
Well, that remains to be seen, right? And at the end of the day, those countries are pretty likely to go to the moon, particularly China, and plant themselves at the poles where there is water. And it's going to, you're right, there's no existing legal regime that actually says, well, who gets which sector? I don't know how they expect it to get sorted out. That's a point you make in your book. Okay, we're here in DC. We have a lot of aerospace engineers, a lot of aerospace companies, and, you know, very much. So as you look at it, what is or will be or should be the economic imperative for the space industry? If it's not getting people into space hotels, what's it going to be? Satellites? Is it telecommunications? Weather? What do you think it's going to be?
Yeah, so I do think there's still loads of money to be made in satellites and, you know, stuff in low Earth orbit. There is some interest in getting more tourists up there into low Earth orbit. But in terms of, sorry, in terms of settlements, the finances to me seem like they're going to be maybe the hardest part. So, you know, who is going to fund that research station on the moon? It's hard to imagine spin-off technologies that are going to be profitable that would be worth investing in. I think coming up with closed loop ecosystems, so just better ways of recycling things in space, is going to be really important for settlements. It's possibly hard to imagine how you make profits off of that. Certainly when Biosphere 2 was set up, there was this idea that there'd be a bunch of sort of spin-off technologies that you can make a lot of money off of. That didn't seem to come to pass. And so, you know, finding ways to make the steps between where we are now and settlement, like the steps needed to make that profitable, or the steps needed to get the technology and to make those technologies profitable, I have a little trouble seeing the path. But I hope that that's because I'm just not creative enough.
Well, you know, frankly, I commend the book, City of Mars. If you're interested, folks, in this this area, you and Zach really came to it from an open-minded view, in my opinion, and looked at this. And you make a very good-humored but very clear argument that the space regulatory regime doesn't exist yet. We're actually going to have some real problems if we try to set up settlements on the moon without having clarity about who owns the water. That'll be found by one nation, but not another. We've got biologic issues. There's some significant impediments, and you're not saying we can't do it. You're saying don't assume it's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure.
But yet there's enormous, forgive the pun, gravimetric pressure that's coming from, you know, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, James Cameron, people with money and a lot of influence. We should go to space. What's driving this behavior?
Well, you know, so with Musk and Bezos, both of them, if you look, you know, into their past, they've been excited about space since they were kids. Bezos gave, you know, his high school speech on rotating space stations. And Musk has been into making humans multiplanetary for a really long time. He thinks this is very important as like a backup system for humanity in case something happens on Earth. So, you know, they've both been excited for a long time. I'm hoping that their billions help us, you know, solve these problems that are really difficult. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like they're investing in solving these problems in particular. They're focusing on the rockets, which is very important. But, you know, I think if billionaires aren't funding some of these perhaps less profitable steps along the way, you know, it could be tough to get there. But I think that they're just genuinely excited about it, like I am. They think the idea of humans in space is awesome.
You know, you're right. If life had unfolded differently and I just become a billionaire instead of a radio show host, I could see where I would be interested in this as well. It's a lot of fun. If nothing else, it's a lot of fun. And it's also somewhat idealistic, which is nice as well. You know, as I sit here and I think about our time together, you know, you're not a buzzkill. I think you're being realistic. What's ultimately the best argument for why we should care about space?
Well, you know, I think there's lots of arguments for why we should care about space in general. I think, you know, the exploration missions have taught us, you know, by looking at Venus, we can, you know, learn a little bit about Earth and how our ozone works and what the impacts of global warming. So there's a lot to say about studying space in general. And, you know, we all interact with satellites, you know, dozens of times a day. But when it comes to settlements, there's maybe fewer good arguments. So I think maybe the best argument is that backup for humanity, but that's not going to happen. Like, a backup for humanity would need to be able to survive even if Earth died. And I think Martians being 100% independent of support from Earth is decades away. So I think we should just kind of slow down and make sure we do it right, because we're not going to be able to rush to make that thing happen.
It's sort of like the original settlers that came to the New World, the United States. Most of those settlements, they didn't succeed because they didn't actually have the ability to support themselves once they didn't have the supply lines from the old world. It's definitely not a new problem. You know, I think that for me, being able to have some part of humanity be able to look at the world and see the blackness and the depth of space, look down and realize this is the only home we have, is probably an experience that I wish more people had. We might be a little bit less willing to throw away what we have here.
I would certainly be keen to have that view. That would be great.
So are you, when the price gets low enough, are you and Zach going to sign up to take a little tourist trip to space?
So to me, it'll be a combination of the price and also how many times it's been done 100% safely. And maybe then I'd go. But I'm gonna wait a little while.
So all I can tell you, Kelly, is that I get airsick on roller coasters, and so while I would love to go to outer space, I have a funny feeling that free fall just won't agree with me. But you know, we'll keep in touch and we'll see how it goes. Listen, it was great having you on the show, folks. That was Kelly Wintersmith. She and her husband Zach have written A City on Mars. I definitely commend you to check it out. I really enjoyed it. Kelly, it was great having you on the show today. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
What's working in Washington? That's a question we often hear. The reality is, Washington works every day at looking at the issues that have to be addressed, solving problems when we can, but more than anything, the crossroads for where change will occur and needs to occur. This show, What's Working in Washington, brings voices into the studio so you can hear from them what they want to do and how they want to contribute. We love hearing from our listeners. You put us in touch with some of the best voices in the Washington, D.C. region. We've been hearing from you and speaking to the people you want to hear from. That's what What's Working in Washington is about. We talk to the power players about innovation in the federal government and how business in the region is keeping us competitive. But more and more, we talk about the hard questions and look for the real answers that will drive the region and our nation forward. If you know someone we should be talking to on our show, do let us know. We look to shine a spotlight on people who are really getting things done in the region. So please keep those ideas coming. And thanks to all of you who stay in touch with us. This program is brought to you in partnership with George Mason University's Center for Regional Analysis. The CRA is the region's leading voice in economic data and forecasting. Check out their work at cra.gmu.edu. Working in Washington is a team effort. We have a great team. Tracy Madigan is our executive producer and editor. Laura Latendresse is our digital producer. The theme music you've been listening to is performed by the Sunbathers. And thanks to all of you for joining us on What's Working in Washington.
You've been listening to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.